We were only doing what as Christians we were under obligations to do by warring against the enemies of our faith, by which means we secured to ourselves glory in another world and gained greater honor and rewards in this life than had fallen to the lot of any other generation at any former period, that they should also reflect that God was on our side and that to Him nothing is impossible, as they might see in the victories we had gained, where so many of the enemy were killed without any loss on our part. These and similar things I said to them, by means of which, and the royal favor of your highness, they recovered their spirits and were induced to do what I desired in order to complete what I had already begun. In his report to King Charles V of Spain, Hernan Cortes summarizes his sense of duty to God and king in his conquest of the Aztec Empire, as he set one faction of it against the other. It was a course that led to Spain's colonization of much of the New World. What sort of man emerges from his detailed accounts of Spanish expeditions in Mexico? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
What did Cortes find when he first came to the New World early in the 16th century? How successful were his expeditions, and what were his attitudes towards the people he found in the New World? Our guest again is Brenda Becerra Anderson, doctoral candidate in the UW-Madison Department of Spanish and Portuguese, who has studied the writings of Cortes in the original 16th century Spanish.
Welcome back to University of the Year.
Thank you.
Can we start with the concept of the conquistador? You know, what would make Cortes a conquistador, and where did that concept come from?
Well, many in Spain at this time were hearing these stories of the Americas and what they had. So it was really a way for Spaniards that did not have noble titles and they were more commoners, it was a way to rise quickly. So they were motivated by this fame and riches and would join expeditions. They would go to the south of Spain in Sevilla, and when they got the opportunity, they would join an expedition and try to rise quickly through those ranks. And they got their name because they started conquering new lands. That was the main reason.
So they're kind of a combination explorer and soldier?
Yes, definitely. They had a lot of experience as soldiers. They served the Spanish crown in a variety of battles. And when these opportunities came along, they jumped to them because it was a way to easily get noble titles that otherwise they probably wouldn't be able to obtain staying in the peninsula.
And if we start with Columbus, 1492 and subsequent years, he was already, in a way, kind of a conquistador in that he was subjugating the natives. It was not universally approved of back in Spain, I gather.
Mm-hmm.
But Cortes follows him by not many years at all.
Right. This is not too far behind him. Cortes started early on, and he was very successful in helping to conquer the island. So he helped with the Dominican Republic and Cuba. And from there on, he wanted to go to the mainland and continue his career.
And how good a map was he using? I mean, in other words, how much of a surprise did he find at the other end of his journey?
Well, for his expedition to Mexico, that was a big surprise. He was the first to go to central Mexico, so to go inland. And they knew the coast pretty well. They and were used to seeing smaller indigenous tribes. But once they reached Tenochtitlan and see an empire, I mean, this was something very new for the Spaniards.
He uses some, literally, incredible numbers when he describes the Indians that he found in central Mexico. I mean, we're talking about tens and in some cases even more than 100,000 people. And these vast cities, I think he mentions a marketplace with 30,000 people coming to trade goods.
Correct.
Must have been quite the stunning experience to find himself amid all these people. And yet somehow this relative handful of Spaniards conquered them.
Right.
What was their technique?
Well, they had the technology. They had horses. They were bringing cannons. They had guns. So they had that on their part. a big thing that Cortez had that he minimizes in his texts are the interpreters. They play a crucial role in the expeditions and in the conquest. They're the intermediaries that are able to speak to the tribes and to the Spaniards. And in his texts, he calls them, in the Spanish texts, he calls them lenguas, which is translated to tongues. But they were really the interpreters, and they had main roles.
Yeah, it's interesting if you read his account, his reports to the King of Spain, how he can describe fairly intricate thinking on the part of the Aztecs. And you wonder, like in one case, he's just eavesdropping. And how did he get all this? So obviously he did have people who, even this early on, were very capable translators.
Yes, and it's something that Colón didn't have, Christopher Columbus, in the beginning of his expeditions. But Cortés met, when he arrived to the Yucatán, he met a Franciscan priest, Jerónimo de Aguilar, and he knew the Mayan dialect because he had been captive there for a couple years. So he had one Spaniard that could speak Mayan, and then along his way, he was given 20 female slaves, and one of them is very famous in Mexico, and she's known as La Malinche. That was his mistress, interpreter. She played a crucial role, and she spoke Nahuatl, which is what the Aztecs spoke, and Mayan as well. So she knew a variety of languages and eventually learned Spanish. So then she became the sole interpreter for Cortez.
Not just the language, but of course the culture.
And the culture as well,
all those kind of fine points.
Mm-hmm. And because of that knowledge that the interpreters could find, that's how Cortez knew that the Aztec city had all these riches and a huge motivation for him to get there, regardless of the cost.
I wonder if some of the interpreters felt caught between two worlds, because by translating, they were facilitating a conquest of, in some case, their own people. So I would think that would put them in a tricky situation. I also wondered, when I was looking at the excerpts from his document, his letters, how accurate some of this is, because he's trying to make himself look good. He wants the favor of the king. And maybe you could say something about the motivation to write these letters to begin with, because that, I guess, makes us look with a bit of a skeptical eye on just how much of the truth we're going to get.
Yes. By default, they become historians, because they're telling us their story first person. But it is something we always have to keep in mind, is their motivations. And as you're saying, he writes these letters to the king to justify his trip. He is rejecting the orders and disobeying the governor of Cuba. And he wants to continue this expedition, even though the governor has told him no. So he makes it, he creates his discourse. So he is serving the king, serving Spain, and he is bringing back knowledge. And he continues, you know, throughout his writings, he's referring to, I'm hearing this information that there's this huge Aztec city, there's these riches, there's their ruler, Montezuma, and I must get there. And this is all for the king. And then as he's going on, he's naming places and he's giving these lands to the king. He's saying that they're his already. So he's able to kind of flip it. So he was a rebel, but now he's
a loyal servant.
Right, a loyal servant of the king.
We see that that's one of the wedges that Cortez uses to gain power as he comes in. He will convert, in a general sense, one group of Indians to his cause, usually by roughing them up a little bit, and then getting enlisting their aid in fighting their enemies.
Right. In his writings, as he's going through his journey, he's just listing off that, now the king, now you have this town. They're all your vassals, and they're all going to serve you. They're all going to be loyal servants. Montezuma becomes his loyal servant. These lands are the king's. Yes, and he's able to convince them through violence.
What do you conclude about the personality of Cortez, including what he was like when he decided to become an explorer, a conquistador? But just in general, sort of reading between the lines, do you get a sense of his personality? I mean, was he ambitious, presumably, and egotistical?
very, I feel like he builds himself as this very masculine man. He's, in his writings, he's shown as this central, very strategic figure. He's smart. He's strategic in his military decisions. He's not too rash in his thinking. He's very reflective. So he'll be given information by interpreters or by natives of tribes, and then he'll reflect on it, and then he'll make a decision. And usually that decision is a good one. And that's how he, it seems like his trip to the Aztec city is, you know, pretty easy on him and his men. And they're able to hold the ruler, Montezuma, hostage without many casualties.
It's kind of interesting that here Cortez is finding the City of Gold, mm-hmm. which was so elusive for poor Cabeza de Vaca to the north. I'm almost surprised that he ever even bothered to look farther north when there was this incredible rich cache of gold and other treasure in Mexico already.
Mm-hmm. This is a strategy that unfortunately failed the natives. So in his journey, he's met by representatives of Montezuma, and they're giving him these presents, and they're giving him golds and cloths and slaves, and they're saying, don't come to our city, there's nothing there, you're not going to like
kind
it.
The reverse Chamber of Commerce
right,
thing.
They're trying to play this psychological trick on him, but it doesn't work. And all these presents that he receives, it's just fueling his ambition, like, well, I need to know the source, like, I know that he has to have more. So the strategy of giving him presents doesn't work. It fails them tremendously. So they have no other choice but to invite him in. And we see that then he takes power over the city.
And how does he handle the loss of life? I mean, there are massacres going on, brutality. Do you
right.
get any sense that Cortez had any qualms? Or is this just done for the sake of the king and whoever dies, it's too bad?
It's always in the name of God. So the ones that do survive, and when they get out of survive some terrible situations, it's because of the grace of God. And they just use that discourse, I think, to keep them going and keep the motivation going. And his journey to the Aztec city, most of those battles, he's exaggerating that his men were not touched and he was able to massacre hundreds and thousands
and he's
of
boasting,
natives.
Right?
Yes, he is. He's showing his military strategy, like he has this under control for the king and he just needs resources. And he shows how easily he's able to take over the city.
Which, again, is the opposite experience that Cabeza de Vaca was going to have just a few years later. I mean, he's quite, no pun intended, pointed in saying how the arrows of the Indians pierce their armor and how excellent they are as marksmen. I mean, and his force of 300 is dwindled down to 4 before it's all over. But Cortez is implying that the Indians have no defense against this relatively small group of Spaniards.
Right. Yeah, Cabeza de Vaca was much more humble and gave credit to the natives. He gave us a little more of a realistic view of their abilities. And Cortez, he's more focused on representing himself in a favorable light and his men to show that he's doing the just thing. He's going through his obligation to the crown and to God.
So the Spanish authorities, king, of course, included, were really thinking of this as, I mean, seriously, in addition to the other perks, as an extension of Christianity.
That was their justification for it, yes.
Almost like a missionary journey that they would go conquer these benighted souls.
And convert them, that they needed them. So they needed the Christians to convert them, or else they wouldn't get exposed to Christianity any other way.
So did they establish then, as they would again slightly later to the north, a whole mission network in Mexico and in this part of Mexico? We're talking about what's centering around Mexico City and that part of Mexico?
Yes. And that's why in these expeditions they had missionaries with them. And then they would start building.
And in the letters that Cortez writes to the king, how much of what he's doing is also almost like a travel narrative? You know, let me tell you about these exotic things that I saw along the way.
Oh, it very much is, especially when we get to Tenochtitlan. This is something new for them. So he is in awe of this huge empire, something that they haven't seen before, very different from the islands that they knew well and had described in previous writings. So he is giving a lot of new information to the king, and a lot of it's hard to believe.
Give me an example of something that he says it's hard to believe.
Well, let's see. Inside the city, they had these gigantic temples. So readers at home and the king could understand, he calls them mosques, but they're temples. But that was just his way to relate it. So he would call them mezquitas in Spanish. And then they had these big markets, and it was a very orderly society. So this was a new concept that they hadn't seen before, seeing these markets as abundance of products, commerce, and nobles, these huge houses, houses of leisure. They had zoos in these houses, all specimens caged up. And there was a house of monstrosities with dwarves and disfigured people for kind of like the circus for entertainment. And this was just something that they hadn't seen before.
But you're saying it was exaggerated, or that there are parts that he's saying that we kind of dismiss as fantastic or beyond the realm of reality?
He gives a warning that it might not be believed because it's kind of the realm of the fantastic. And it's more because we haven't seen the native populations before in this, in a setting of an empire.
We hear, if you read about the Mayans, for example, some of the other civilizations from somewhat earlier, it sounds like it was not exactly a fun place to be, you know, the kind of amount of sacrifice that went on and sort of the casual approach to taking human life. And it's almost as if those earlier empires may have fallen apart because people just didn't enjoy living in them that much. But what kind of life, what kind of sense of life does Cortez give us of the Aztec way of day-to-day existence? I realize it would have been somewhat disrupted by his very presence, but I gather he had some notion.
Right. In his journey, he is discovering that all these small towns are under the jurisdiction. A lot of them are. And they're all loyal servants of the Aztec Empire. And they have to pay tribute to them. And then he finds ones that are their rivals, which he takes advantage of that. That's definitely his military strategy. And once he reaches the Aztec city, there we see kind of like a metropolitan, we can say, because he describes the daily commerce that's going on. And he says everything's very orderly. He shows how natives will be punished for breaking the laws. They have their currency. It's a very much organized city.
He has one account of crime and punishment, I guess you could call it, when someone has stolen some of his gold, which, of course, he had already stolen from the locals.
It's the second person stealing, right?
But he describes in his account that a search was made for the thief, and he was traced to a city in the neighborhood, and there they brought him as a prisoner from there, delivered him to me with the gold, saying that I must have him punished. I acknowledged in suitable terms the pains they had taken in the matter, but remarked to them, this is a good kind of diplomatic ploy here, remarked to them that since the prisoner was in their country, they should punish him according to their custom, and that I chose not to interfere with the punishment of their people while I remained among them. They thanked me, and taking the man, carried him to the great market, a town crier making public proclamations of his offense. They then placed him at the base of a structure resembling a theater, which stands in the midst of the marketplace, while the crier went to the top of the building and with a loud voice again proclaimed his offense, whereupon the people beat him with sticks until he was dead.
But by having it be their custom, he has no responsibility then for
right.
the theft that triggered the theft.
Mm-hmm. And he shows the empire kind of like a mini civilization. It was something that they didn't attribute to the natives of the Americas. Before, the discourse was that there were these savages. They were pagans. They didn't have organized societies like the Europeans did. So arriving in Tenochtitlan was an awakening of that they did have these metropolitan areas and they had these empires. And
they had customs and laws.
Customs and laws, correct.
He's sort of respecting their way of handling this particular crime, which would make you wonder, well, why not respect the sort of integrity and autonomy of the civilization itself? We're going to look more at Spanish conquistador Hernán Cortés when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest Brenda Becerra Anderson, who's telling us about the conquistador, Hernán Cortés, and his experiences in the early 16th century in Mexico. How native did these Spaniards go once they got there? It's pretty common, isn't it, for a lot of conquerors to become absorbed. I mean, you know, the Norman, French, and English history, for example. They became so English they couldn't even speak French after a few generations. But these conquistadors in Central America, how much did they absorb and how much did the Aztecs absorb of their culture?
Right. Well, with Cortez, this is where we have an example. I guess the first documentation of a mestizo, of a mixed breed between a Spaniard and indigenous. We are sure it happened before, but it wasn't documented and included in their letters. But we do find out through him and his main interpreter, La Malinche, that they had a son, Martin, and he had multiple children. He did not marry La Malinche. He married a Spaniard. But it's interesting that he, at the end of his life, in his will, made sure his children, all his children, were taken care of, including the illegitimate ones.
And he had quite a few illegitimate ones in Mexico, right?
Correct. Yes. So that's very interesting to see and for it to be documented.
And he seems to have wanted to go back to Mexico, ultimately.
He did. He had a lot of legal battles in Spain and had received titles, but it seems that he probably just felt more vindicated back in the Americas. And he requested to be buried there and, yeah, wanted to lay a rest. So, yeah, it was something about the Americas that attracted him. And even after life, he wanted to be there.
Well, among these Spaniards, and we see this again a little bit in the writings of Cabeza de Vaca, although there wasn't as much to fight over in their case. They didn't really manage to lay their hands on very much. But in the case of Cortez and his cohorts, they have all this power. They have all this wealth. They have all this freedom. How did it affect the cohesion of the Spanish force?
It definitely weakened it. That's where we see Spaniards taking the law into their own hands and making their own decisions. That's where we see a lot of the drama and bickery. That's how this expedition started. Cortez was denied the expedition, and he decides he's going to do it by his own means.
Sort of go rogue.
Go rogue, right. And he does. And that infuriates the governor of Cuba. And that's why later on in his journey, he wants to be stopped. So he sends out an expedition with Pánfilo de Narváez to stop Cortés and stop his expedition.
Was some of that worry that Cortés was getting out of hand in terms of his use of power or that he was hoarding some of the wealth for himself? Or
both. Yes, that was a fear. He was moving up pretty quickly. Because he was a main figure, he did help. He helped the governor take over Cuba, and the governor gave him titles and land. But Cortez wanted more. You know, he wanted most of, he aspired to be his own governor, you know, and, and he wanted to take over Mexico. So, yeah, that was a fear. They weren't sure if they could trust him and that he would be moderate and or if he would get out of control. And there was always that question of, is he keeping some of that for himself and not being completely truthful and giving it over to the crown?
Did Velasquez actually write down his side of the story, too?
We do not know his side. But there was a soldier, like a common soldier in Cortez's expedition that wrote his own story. And his story, he titled it Historia Verdadera de la Conquista de Nueva España.
The real story.
So it's the true story of the conquest of New Spain. And he wanted to give, Bernal Díaz del Castillo wanted to give the perspective of the soldier instead of always, we see this perspective usually of the commander.
Sure.
And he wanted to give the perspective of the soldier.
What kind of perspective do we get from him?
He actually says good things about Cortez.
Does he?
Is that because he knew it would be read by Cortez? Or?
Well, what sort of differences do we see?
Well, it is because of Bernal Díaz del Castillo that we learn about La Malinche. So Cortez is very much centered on himself, and we know about his actions and his decisions, but he minimizes and really silences anyone else that helps him. So Bernal Díaz, he tells us of the crucial role of the interpreters and gives them names. If it wasn't for him, we wouldn't know her name. He calls her Doña Marina, which is probably her Christian name after they baptized her. And Doña is a noble title, kind of like lady. So it'd be calling her Lady Marina.
Sure.
And he has a lot of good things to say about her and puts her in a crucial role in the conquest. Cortez leaves her out. She's related.
Do you think that's because he didn't want to admit to having that kind of help or that he was protecting her privacy?
Oh, that's a good question. I think it's just because his letters, he needed to get help from and be justified in what he was doing. So they were just really centered on getting the king's attention and getting his permission to continue and getting his resources. So I think because his motivation was, I need the resources from the king. I need his permission. I need to make everything legal so I can continue on the expedition is probably why he just centered on himself and made himself the main figure. In his letters, he calls them una relación, and that was a legal document at that time. So he wanted to show the legality and get that from the king.
In the case of Columbus, when he came into the Caribbean and started subjugating the Indians and reports got back to Spain and the authorities disapproved and said this is no way to Christianize a people, and Columbus comes back to Spain in chains under arrest. What about the goings-on of Cortez? How does that compare to what Columbus did in his relationships with those Caribbean Indians? I mean, it sounds not terribly different.
Right.
How did Cortez fare in the greater politics of the situation?
Mm-hmm. Well, Cortez is very strategic, so he was able to get away with it. We see him be victorious, even though he did lose control of the Aztec city. He finally does get, I think it's by his fourth letter, he receives what he needs from the king and the permission and the legal paperwork so he can go back and conquer. And he does, and then he rules Tenochtitlan for about 4 years.
And how much of that do you think is the power of his prose, his rhetoric, you know, his use of words? I know you have a version of it in the original Spanish. I don't know if you could maybe share some of that and talk about how he is as sort of a master of the language.
Yes. Here I have an excerpt of Cortez addressing the king again in one of his letters, just reminding him of that he's giving him an account of everything that's happening, and it's the truth. So he likes to reiterate this and bring this up every so often during his writing so the king doesn't forget. He writes, Porque para dar cuenta, muy poderoso señor, a vuestra real excelencia de la grandeza, extrañas y maravillosas cosas de esta gran ciudad de Tenochtitlan, del señorío y servicio de este Montezuma, señor de ella, y de los ritos y costumbres que esta gente tiene, y de la orden en la gobernación, así de esta ciudad como de las otras, que eran de este señor. Ay, sería menester mucho tiempo y ser muchos relatores y muy expertos. No podré yo decir en 100 partes una de las que de ellas se podrían decir. Más como pudiere, diré algunas cosas de las que vi, que aunque mal dichas, bien sé que serán de tanta admiración que no podrán creer. Porque los que acá con nosotros, nuestros propios ojos, las vemos, no las podemos con el entendimiento comprender.
Well, tell us what you just read and what makes that special.
Here we see how he uses, how his rhetoric is, he uses that to his advantage. And he's addressing the king and letting him know that he cannot give an account of everything. And it would be hundreds and hundreds of pages. So he's going to be able to do what's feasible. And he's going to relate to him everything that he has seen and to tell him about this new great city and their ruler, and he's going to show what a great place it is, although it could bring up some skepticism because of the information he's going to include.
Skepticism?
Yes.
I mean, just because of how grand this place is?
Grand this place is, right. As I was saying earlier, that this is the first empire that they encounter, so it's going to be a new concept for them.
So it is farther south. Does Pizarro come later?
Yes.
And inspired in part by what Cortez finds in Mexico?
Most likely. Mm-hmm, I would believe so. They all want to go find more places like Tenochtitlan.
In the passage you read, I heard the reference to Montezuma. Tell us about how Cortez portrays Montezuma and their relationship.
Mm-hmm. Well, Montezuma is... It's interesting. He definitely creates him as this some bit of an unreliable figure. He shows that he has authority because when Montezuma tells his people to calm down, not make a scene after he's taken hostage, for the most part they listen and he's able to calm the city down. And he has a lot of vassals and they all listen to him and provide tribute. So he does that. But Cortez is so, he's able to easily take him over, that he builds himself up to be this great conquistador. And Montezuma kind of not as strong of a figure as Cortez.
When you say easily takes him over, by physical force, do they, I mean...
Takes him hostage.
Takes him hostage.
For gold, how? Ransom for, according to one story, it's what, a whole room full of gold or something like that.
Do they seize him
true?
And put him in a...
Well, the way Cortez explains it, he makes it seem as this easy process. He actually just speaks to him in a conversation. So he gets notified that back in the coast, there was a group of Spaniards that got attacked by some of Cortez's natives. So he gets knowledge of this and confronts Montezuma about it. And Montezuma denies having anything to do with it, although his messengers are telling him these are direct orders from him to attack the Spaniards. So he says in a conversation, he negotiates with him and lets him know that he's going to need to hold him hostage until the truth comes out, until they're able to bring back the natives that attacked and get their testimony, and then he'll let him free. And he lets him know not to feel threatened. He will not be treated like a prisoner. He can actually pick his room where he wants to stay, his location. And Montezuma agrees, and he picks his house and where he's going to be, and they set up guard there. So it seemed that there was no struggle. It was
house arrest.
It's more like house arrest. But he doesn't represent any type of struggle, and it was all through negotiation and conversation.
And the outcome is?
They bring back the natives. They claim that it was through his orders. And so then Cortez goes ahead and takes the authority to take over the city and keep him hostage.
And the people just go along with that? There's no revolt at this point?
He says at first that he did observe some disturbance in the city, but Montezuma went out to speak to the people. And it's interesting because he also uses this as, it's another strategy of his. He was a very smart conquistador. He narrates Montezuma's speech to his people after he's taken hostage. And he tells them to calm down, that now they must listen to their new ruler. And he reminds them that they're actually not natives of that country, that they came from elsewhere. And that their god, when they went back, saw that now the Aztecs had intermingled with the natives and let them settle there. So they never brought them back to where they were from originally. So they don't know where they're from. They know that they came from elsewhere and established their city there. So he reminds his people that, and then he attributes that this new lord from Spain could possibly be that their old ruler.
Oh, there were some.
So there's lots
legends,
of those myths, those
there?
Legends,
yeah,
right.
Of,
so he uses that, and then Cortez writes, well, I'm going to make them believe that, yeah, that's us.
The sort of white-skinned guy.
Yeah, we are those. Mm-hmm, part of the legends, and he uses that to his advantage.
That worked with varying degrees of success for various explorers, didn't it? It seems to be a theme that comes up occasionally when you have a European coming into anywhere in the Western Hemisphere, and the natives think, oh, you must be the guy we've been waiting for. And then things usually got sour after that.
Right.
I keep finding myself wanting additional versions, you know, different narratives by the people who could say whether, mm-hmm. you know, Montezuma really said this and conducted himself in such a what sounds like almost a passive way, mm-hmm. passive acceptance.
What does become of Montezuma then?
So when Cortez is notified of this expedition that the governor from Cuba has sent to stop him, he needs to go stop it. So through the problems and the dramas between the Spaniards, what happens is Cortez leaves the city, and then there's a battle, and they start revolting in Tenochtitlan. And they say that there, he claims that the natives of Tenochtitlan got angry at Montezuma and started throwing rocks at him, and that they hit him in the head, and he died 3 days later.
And
so
why,
that's Cortez's version. That's
why would the natives be angry with Montezuma?
Well, for letting Cortez
for
take
letting
over
Cortez
the city,
take him over, seizing the city, yes.
Uh-huh. Do we have
because
other?
Once he leaves is when they take the opportunity to take back control, and they're mad at their ruler
for
letting him so easily. Possibly Montezuma's strategy was to get the Spaniards in the city, maybe get to know them and devise a plan on how to bring them down, but that didn't work. The Spaniards were too quick to take over.
So Cortez and his men then have to take on Velasquez and his counter-expedition, and how does that play out?
He is victorious in against the odds. He's Panfilo's men, he was outnumbered. It was 3-1. And he does a sneak attack at night and is able to capture and get hostage Panfilo and his men.
The governor, Panfilo.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And, this is a name we've heard before.
Yes.
Not a successful governor.
No, he had bad luck in the Americas. He failed at two expeditions, and that last one in Florida, we do not hear from him again.
Yes, Cabeza de Vaca just says, mm-hmm. well, that's the last we saw of the governor. He was adrift on a raft somewhere,
mm-hmm.
never to be heard from again.
We're going to look at the legacy of Hernan Cortez when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
This city is so extensive and so well worthy of admiration that although I omit much that I could say of it, I feel assured that the little I shall say will be scarcely credited, since it is larger than Granada and much stronger and contains as many fine houses and a much larger population than that city did at the time of its capture. And it is much better supplied with its products of the earth, such as corn, and with fowls and game, fish from the rivers, various kinds of vegetables, and other excellent articles of food. There is in this city a market in which every day 30,000 people are engaged in buying and selling, besides many other merchants who are scattered about the city.
That's a description of Tenochtitlan, the Aztec capital of Mexico, being described there by Spanish conquistador Hernan Cortez in the early 16th century. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Brenda Becerra Anderson, and we are talking about Cortez. Again, I'm sort of stuck on the fact that he can describe the intricacy, you know, almost in awe. He is seeing some things that are superior or, you know, more developed than back home in Spain, but he has absolutely no problem justifying conquest and, in many cases, destruction.
Right. And this is where the religious discourse takes a huge role, and where it gives them the justification is they keep saying it's their obligation for Christianity to keep spreading it and to save their souls.
By, you know, ruining this other, that you have to kind of wipe it out and kill some people
right.
in order to do that?
Yes, it was by every means necessary. And that's exactly what they did. They destroyed the city and then rebuilt on top of it. So now if you go to Mexico City, you can see the remains underneath the city of what was the Aztec Empire. You still see some remains, and you see the city sinking a bit because it was built over a lake.
And we still occasionally read about things like mm-hmm. calendars, these huge
being
stone calendars.
Correct.
That are, yes,
mm-hmm.
excavated.
In excavations, correct.
Where did all the gold go?
Where did it go? Well, Cortez, his version, when he decides, his group of men decide that they're losing the battle in Tenochtitlan and that they must escape. So, of course, they need to take the gold with them. They gather up what they can and they try to escape with the gold. Unfortunately, they were severely attacked and most of their arms and gold were lost in the escape.
Yes. Like, how do you lose? How do you lose gold and arms? Just taken?
Just by the killing of the men that were carrying them. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
By the Aztecs.
By the Aztecs, correct.
So we're saying the Aztecs got it back and not much of it got to Spain?
For this event that's what happened.
Uh-huh.
And then after their escape and the gold that they were able to take, Cortez says actually he was using that to pay the tribes that were helping him afterwards. So they were being kicked out of the city, and they continued to be followed, and they were wanting to kick them out probably of the continent.
I'm sure that's true.
They wanted to get them out, get them as far away as they could. So they really needed to rely on other tribes, and they were able to reach some of their allegiances with other towns and get their help. But they said, of course, they wanted some tribute, and they had gold, and they saw that. So he said that they had to give some of that gold to the tribes.
So would Cortez be seen as a success or a failure?
Oh, an abject failure by the Aztecs. Not at all the kind of thing they wanted.
But right. I mean, looking at it, you know, mm-hmm. looking, sort of taking the aerial view of Cortez coming across and doing the various conquests that he did and mm-hmm. all the different things and then going back to Spain, to what extent was it a success for Spain mm-hmm. and to what extent was it a failure?
Well, I think you can say that it was a success. That's how he builds his discourse. He reminds the king that he had these lands pacified and under the king's control in his first expedition. And it's not until the interference of Velasquez that he loses it and then has to retreat, gather up supplies and men once again, and go back to the city. And he is able to go conquer it again. He is able to take down the new ruler after Montezuma. And he sets up his city. He constructs a new city. And is there for 4 years until he's requested to go back to Spain to deal with some lawsuits from his men. And he was convicted of treason. And there were so many
little minor
details that he had to go take care of. So for the crown, I mean, he was able to conquer the city.
And did this really lead to the enrichment of the Spanish crown? I mean, mm-hmm. was Spain before this in need of cash, and did this whole experience really help out the treasury, make Spain a much more powerful political force?
Yes, Mexico City remained one of the main cities in Latin America. It was a huge force to have that. These expeditions were private enterprises, so the crown actually wasn't funding them. They were finding by others, and Cortez used some of his own money.
I gather, so that, yeah, he died well off.
Yeah, he did, and was able to provide for all his children. So, yeah, they definitely benefited from having that. And just a central location, it was such a big capital city, an urban city, that it was well-known and used.
And what did Cortez do in the later years of his life? How did he end his career?
He did participate in a few more expeditions, and then he went back to retire and take care of his lawsuits. Nothing became of that. They took some of his money and died in Spain.
Was he a famous figure throughout Spain? I mean, was he held up as a somewhat heroic figure or controversial one?
Probably a controversial one because of all the different allegations that came to him. But he was able to clear his name. So he did get titles, and he was recognized for what he did. But, yeah, I guess controversial at the same time.
And we mentioned Pizarro. Who were the others that followed him because of, you know, what he had done and the work that he had made known? Mm-hmm. How did the empire continue to expand based on his experience?
Right. Well, they kept going north of Mexico. Cortez did help discover Baja California.
No gold, though.
And then just along down Central America and South America was big. The Portuguese had Brazil, but the rest of South America was huge.
So what would you say was the legacy of Cortez? I mean, the most important thing about him, you know? Mm-hmm. If it had been somebody other than Cortez, things could have gone a different way and so on. I mean, how would you say his particular brand of conquest, mm-hmm. his approach, the writing he did and so on, left a lasting mark? Mm-hmm.
Yes, I think he will always be known as the conqueror of Mexico. And that was his ticket to fame and I think what his biggest service to the crown was. Mm-hmm. And his writings, he made sure that they gave him the authority and created that mythical figure of the very masculine, strategic conquistador.
And so how are the conquistadors thought of today in Mexico in particular? Mm-hmm. You know, they're obviously the cultures and the races have blended considerably, perhaps more there than anywhere else. Mm-hmm. But is there any kind of a feeling, especially mm-hmm. in more recent times when, mm-hmm. you know, indigenous cultures had a resurgence. How is mm-hmm. Cortez thought of in Mexico?
That's interesting. The conquistadores are nowadays, they're still controversial figures because they were the initiators of those movements and the blending of cultures. But it's interesting because in Mexico, actually, the figure that produced more controversy was his mistress, La Malinche.
Really?
Because
for
of her being a native.
Like a betrayal.
Right. And that's why a term formed, Malinchista. So that's a negative term. That's, it means traitor of
really?
Country. Yes. So she's a controversial figure. But, you know, with the times, more people are embracing her figure. They rewrite history. They show her in a better light. So it kind of depends on the time period and the historians. But she continues to be a controversial figure. Although women now, I think, kind of with more of the feminist movement, are embracing this strong female figure and trying to change the negative connotation of La Malinche to a more positive one.
Mm-hmm. And I suppose there are lots of evidences of Cortez in some ways, if he had all those natural children who would have gone on to produce descendants.
So what percent of the population of Mexico is thought to be descended from Cortez?
I'm not sure, but I'm going to go ahead and include myself in there and say I'm pretty sure I'm a descendant of Cortez.
And how does that make you feel?
I'm troubled. My identity is very troubled.
You're conflicted.
Yes.
Well, thanks for sharing some of your insights and experiences and perspectives on a still controversial figure after 500 years. That would be Hernan Cortez, or as we call him up here sometimes, Hernando Cortez. Our guest has been Brenda Becerra Anderson. A pleasure as always.
Thank you.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach. I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air.